The media are more crooked than Jimmy Hoffa ever was. They're more dishonest than your average bribe-taking building inspector in Queens. They're more treacherous than the mafia. They make cops in Tijuana look trustworthy. You'll get a fairer treatment.
That's Tucker Carlson. I don't think we've got the Tim Michaels feature here, so we'll just move on with our guest this morning because we've got a roundtable joining us, taking a look at the Americans' confidence in newspapers and TV news, which has, according to Gallup's annual survey of trust in U.S. institutions, fallen to all-time lows. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and in for Kate Archer Kent today. And as Gallup points out, political party affiliation is now the most likely reason for someone's opinion of the media's trustworthiness. What are the factors driving these trends? What happens if these trends continue? And what can be done to restore some trust in our institutions? Hindsight, it's rather fitting that Tucker Carlson brings us into the conversation because that's a part of it, isn't it? The media landscape. I'd be interested in hearing your take this morning at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's get to our roundtable of guests this morning. Joining us, Michael Wagner, professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be with you.
Also joining us this morning is Izzy Papakarisi. He's a professor and head of the Communication Department and Political Science professor at the University of Illinois Chicago. Zizi, welcome to you.
Pleasure to be here.
And also this morning, the Washington Post media critic, Eric Wemple. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
And Eric, I'm going to start with you because you worked on our panel. You're the one at the newspaper, The Washington Post. Were you surprised by these Gallup findings that trust in TV news and newspapers have reached an all-time low by their numbers?
No, because they seem to be, they keep doing that every couple of years. So if you look at the trend line, it's a pretty much steady, you know, there are some spikes here and there. There was a spike, I believe, sort of like in the early Trump years, because the newspapers were aggressively covering Trump, and I think the Democrats appreciated that. So there's a couple spikes, but the trend is generally downward. And as Gallup measures it, public trust in the media is hitting new all-time lows every so often. Of course, there's only so much further it can drop. That's one of the problems.
So at a certain point, if these trends persist, and this was pointed out, we could reach no trust, no confidence in our TV news and newspapers. Zizi Papakarisi, political science professor and the chair of the communications department at U of I Chicago. What's behind these trends?
A number of different things. First, people are smarter. They're more informed. They're more skeptical, and they're also a little bit more cynical. They've seen a lot. They've been disappointed by what they've seen. They're disillusioned. They're coming out of a pandemic. In short, media and politicians are going to have to work harder to earn the public's trust. The old tricks are not going to work, and then the new tricks work more than once. And then in addition to that, you know, we're dealing with a public that's been oversaturated with information of dubious quality that most people do not have the means or the time to evaluate.
And where is this dubious information coming from? Is it coming from TV news? Is it coming from newspapers?
It's coming from a number of different places, present company excluded, of course. But it exists within its own reinforcing, reproducing feedback loop that includes TV outlets, print, legacy media outlets, and of course is regurgitated and propagated through a variety of social media platforms that have all kinds of, some of them have very specific ideological affiliations.
That's Zizi Papakarisi, the head of the communications department at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Also, Eric Wemple, media critic for The Washington Post. And Mike Wagner from UW-Madison, I want to ask you, because you bring us this Wisconsin perspective, what is it in Wisconsin that has diminished the trust in news sources?
Well, I think it's a variety of things, and I agree with what Zizi was just saying moments ago. But I would say in Wisconsin, part of what's happening is that American public opinion is largely, not wholly, but largely driven by political elites. And so what our politicians say, what our key and most popular news media report to us. It helps people, as Zizi was saying, who are really busy and don't have the time to sift through everything. It sends signals. And so if I know that I trust this particular source, it helps me as a citizen realize, oh, this is maybe what I think and what people like me might think about a particular issue. And in Wisconsin, in a 24-hour period, you can hear over 80 hours of conservative talk radio. And much of conservative talk radio does what we call working the refs, which is to say complaining about media bias, hoping that it'll influence media coverage to go easier on conservative causes. And this is something that's been happening in our state and around the country for 3 decades now, and it's certainly not the only cause. I don't want to say that, but it's certainly something that sticks out as a large independent effect on our diminishing trust, which is that conservative radio talk shows regularly disparage the news media. They claim that the news media are all liberal. They claim that national reporters drive by and don't care about what's happening in the things that they cover outside of New York, Washington, and Los Angeles. And while there are certainly fair critiques to be made of how the news media cover politics and other social issues, the constant drumbeat of these people are not to be trusted causes a problem, so much so that Wisconsin's former conservative talk radio host Charlie Sykes said that it was partially conservative talk radio that was to blame in Wisconsin for the rise of former President Trump, because Sykes, a strong Republican, longtime supporter of Governor Walker, would say, hey, Donald Trump is a liar. He's not to be trusted.
Oh, and with that, I think we've lost Mike Wagner briefly. I apologize, but we have a chance to go to your calls and questions this morning at 1-800-642-1234, where Jim in Rice Lake is standing by. Jim, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I just want to contribute that I think we tend to focus too much on our immediate past. And if you review American 19th century, late 18th century politics, sociopaths and what was called yellow journalism has been with us for a very long time. There's an old joke of two presidential candidates. One said of one, the joke was, "Ma, ma, where's your pa? Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha." In that one of the candidates accused one of slandering illegitimate children. So this level of low base argument has existed with us historically, but we now have the technology of yellow journalism to make it writ large. I'll be interested in your guest comments.
Yeah, I don't know who wants to handle that, but I'd ask you, Eric, as the media critic of the Washington Post, your reaction to this is yellow journalism is nothing new, and why the reduction in trust now?
Well, I think that's true. I think that there's a great tradition in American journalism history of, you know, stretching the truth for partisan ends. I agree with what Mike was saying, and I think that the listener's comment was also on point. My main thing about this trust question for, say, mainstream media organizations like the Washington Post, ABC News, NBC News, CNN, MSNBC, so on and so forth, is that, yes, all these organizations, all our organizations should be doing everything possible to enhance trust. We should be correcting when we're wrong. We should be fact-checking. We should be doing all the blocking and tackling, all the journalism 101 things that we need to do to make our product more trustworthy. And I believe that most of these organizations are indeed doing that. The New York Times has an entire team that does nothing but focus on trust issues. And so that has to be done. But I would say you can't have this discussion without talking about Fox News. Fox News was founded in some large degree to hammer mainstream media news organizations and to illegitimately depress trust in those organizations. And they do it every day, and they do it systematically, and they have been doing it systematically since 1996. They have been the leading cable news outlet since like 2002. And if you look at the Gallup chart, you know, it's a particularly craggy cliff from 2002 onward on the trust meter. So my point is that news organizations can do everything possible, everything in the world to enhance trust and to make their product pure as the driven snow. Yet it'll only be tinkering around the margins as long as Fox News continues its what I would call a campaign to to diminish the public's trust in these organizations.
It's Eric Wempel, media critic for The Washington Post, with us for the hour, along with the rest of our panel. We've got Mike Wagner back, teaches journalism at UW-Madison, and Zizi Papakarisi, the head of the communications department at the University of Illinois Chicago, also a political science professor. If you have questions for our panel or you want to dig into what these numbers or what you see, funny, these numbers were about TV news or newspapers, and what Mike brought up was the radio landscape here across Wisconsin. Get your reaction to that, as well as our panelists' reaction when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. New numbers from Gallup suggest our trust in newspapers and TV news has never been lower. So we've assembled a panel to look behind those numbers, find the reasons and what we can do, if anything, to change them, and what could happen if they persist. Be interested in your reaction this morning at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org for our panel, Washington Post media critic Eric Wempel, Mike Wagner from the UW-Madison, and Zizi Papakarisi, political scientist at the University of Illinois Chicago. And Zizi, I wanted to ask you a follow-up with this, because Mike references the talk radio landscape across Wisconsin as perhaps one of the reasons behind this. Eric cites Fox News specifically and points to the numbers starting when Fox News starts as correlating with Gallup's numbers. So is media part of the problem for the lack of media's trust, Zizi?
Thank you for the question. I'm wanting to offer some insight on this and clarify some of what my co-conversants have been saying. So I think there's a tendency to oversimplify the issue when we rely on polling numbers. And as much as I respect and have been using Gallup data myself, you know, since I was a graduate student, we have to understand that polls often present issues in ways that are binary, that often produce polarizing responses, and often make generalizations that are unjust. So it would be incorrect to say that the public mistrusts all media. There is coverage out there that's legitimate, that's very decent, that people trust. So it's really a statement that we must apply, that we must interpret with a lot of nuance. It's more of an issue of which media do what kind of people trust. And I do think that there are some data that you mentioned that point to some connections between ideological affiliation and then the variety of media that people tend to lean on being a little bit more pronounced these days. That's something to be looked at as well.
Have an email here from Matt in Madison. And again, you can email our panel ideas at WPR.org, and says he's also concerned about Fox News, saying there are no repercussions these days for lying to the American people, saying that they don't know when the truth became optional, but it certainly has. The truth optional, Mike Wagner, or is there, what comprises the media, I guess, is information, propaganda. Is truth optional?
I don't think that truth is optional. There are things that are verifiably true, and there are things that aren't. And there are things where it's gray. It might depend on the context of when a statement is made or when a fact is wholly accurate or not. But what I think is changing is there's less agreement across sources, as there are just so many more places for people to get their information. And part of what's happening, trust in the media. My colleagues and I have done a set of research studies, both surveys and focus groups, where we ask people, what do you think of when you hear the phrase the media? And there's nothing that comes out and is a strong majority answer. CNN is the plurality winner, and maybe 20% of people will say CNN. But when we ask people to think about local media, then they're thinking of local television, local newspapers, and their trust is quite high. And if we ask them to think about their favorite sources, their trust is quite high. And so it's not just that the media, whatever that is something that is experiencing diminishing trust. It's that we have political leaders and some news sources choosing to ignore things that are plainly true to continue to try to make political points, increase their own power, disparage the power of others. And so far, too many citizens are allowing that to happen without repercussions for the political leaders and news organizations that trade in that kind of lying.
That's Mike Wagner, professor of UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Also reminding you, Eric Wemple here, media critic at The Washington Post, and Zizi Papakarisi, chair of the University of Illinois Chicago Communications Department, taking your questions about the media landscape and the trust we have in it today at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, where Judy in Green Bay is standing by. Judy, you're on The Morning Show.
Hello, good morning. I have a kind of a question, and it's also an observation, and I just like to hear other thoughts on it. I believe that people, when you talk to them, have a very distrustful view of the government, both sides, Democrats, Republicans, and also like common people as far as money they give to the government or their taxes, everything. And they have theories that people are out to get them. And I just remember when I was younger, my parents, it was so different around, you know, people were going to war for their country. And it didn't seem like there was all those other undertones. So I'm just curious to hear other thoughts around that observation.
Well, let's pose this one to Eric Wemple, media critic at The Washington Post. Why do people gravitate toward these negative perceptions of government and on both sides, Eric?
That is a really good question. I think, you know, politics has become kind of our national obsession. It was particularly acute during the Trump years when I think that people felt they no longer had the luxury of ignoring politics. So it's become front and center. It's become, you know, when Politico was launched in 2007, there was some skepticism as to whether the, you know, Washington media could absorb an organization that covered nothing but politics. How naive was that reaction? You know, it's like politics is our national sport now, and it's the way that we communicate. It's the way, and we don't necessarily communicate in a very civil manner either. But I think that is it, namely that it's how we tribalize. It's how we sort ourselves. That's our national sort of pathology at this point, I'm afraid. And I don't know why it has happened, but it certainly has. And I think that there's a self-reinforcing cycle between cable news. I always go back to cable news because even though it doesn't have that huge an audience, everybody knows what's going on with cable news. It's huge on social media, and it has a sociocultural sort of impact that I think it's hurting the country. So my number one culprit would be cable news. And I think all the other explanations after that one, I find a little weak. But anyhow, that's my shot at that. It's not really, I'm not really a sociologist, so it's just a sort of a seat of the pants diagnosis.
You're the media critic at The Washington Post. I would be interested in it. I think we'd all be interested in your perspective on that. And Zizi, we've got the news coming up, but with about the minute or so that we have left here, I am curious, did you see journalists being worse at their jobs now than they were decades ago when people trusted them more?
No, not at all. But I would just very quickly say that what the public wants is a long-term relationship with journalism. And often what they get is an encounter of a fleeting nature. And I will leave it at that, and perhaps we can pick up on that later.
Absolutely, and I appreciate it. Zizi Papakarisi joining us this morning, the chair of the University of Illinois Chicago Communications Department and a professor of political science. Heard from Eric Wemple there, the media critic at The Washington Post, and Michael Wagner joining us, professor in UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Also invite you to the conversation following the news here at 1-800-642-1234. ask you what you see when it comes to trust in the media landscape, whether it is the cable news, whether it is radio or newspapers themselves. And maybe there is an issue of you trust your sources, but you don't trust mine. And if that's the case, what does it say about what we can expect next? Be interested in you joining this conversation this hour at 1-800-642-1234 or always email available ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn. News is next on the Ideas Network. New polling numbers from Gallup suggest a crisis in confidence when it comes to American news media. It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Kate Archer Kenton, trust in TV news and newspapers have dropped to all-time lows, according to Gallup. But, you know, it's not that simple. Politico.com senior media writer Jack Schaefer points to Fenno's paradox. His 1978 political scientist Richard Fenno found that while people may disapprove of Congress in general, they tend to support their own congressmen. And maybe Fenno's paradox can be applied to our own trust in news media. While it's never been lower generally, we still trust our own go-to news sources. Does that resonate with you? And if that's part of what's happening here, what are the consequences of it continuing? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation and our panel this hour, or email ideas at WPR.org. Zizi Papakarisi is the head of the communications department at the University of Illinois Chicago. Eric Wemple is the media critic for the Washington Post. And Mike Wagner, journalism and political science professor at UW-Madison. We go back to your calls now, where Marion Portage is standing by. Mary, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to ask you your opinion on how we are supposed to believe any outlet that's funded with by advertisers, such as the pharmaceutical industry, the oil industry.
That's yeah, I think maybe, Eric, we'd go to you on this one. But I remember the story from The New York Times just a few days ago about Alex Jones and the radio network that was built around him, the Genesis Communications, I believe. And this New York Times called it economics of misinformation.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a great question. You know, news consumers are very much entitled to judge and to change their views of news organizations based on their advertisers. The defense of this by most mainstream news organizations, which do have pharmaceutical advertising, is that, well, we open the door to advertising from all sorts of advertisers. In other words, pharmaceutical companies, the anti-pharmaceutical lobby, so on and so forth, such that it creates a plurality or a great, multifarious advertising base that all basically cancels itself out, and that therefore they are able to do their journalism without undue influence from one interest group or another. I think the real problem is when some news organizations rely too much on a certain advertiser, say for example, their convention or their conference business is always sponsored by the same company. I think that's problematic. But I would also point out the countervailing point, which is that news organizations cannot run without money. They can't investigate wrongdoing without money. They can't do accountability journalism without money, without advertising. Many news organizations are now trying to migrate to a subscription model, which means that they're less beholden to particular interests and big advertisers and more beholden to all their subscribers, which can be a good thing. But it can also be a bad thing, because if all their subscribers feel the same way about something, the same sort of pressures you'll find will mount on that news organization. So there's no pure way to fund a news organization. And so I'll just leave it at that.
Eric, thank you. And Zizi, earlier I had asked you about whether or not journalists are worse at their job just to be, because the trust had been reduced. And I wanted to follow up with that because Eric talks about the money that's needed to make this business, these businesses work, the media business work. Is perhaps part of this that we have fewer journalists and that may be a reduction in trust?
I would be concerned, not about advertising dollars, but more about the kind of content that they need for advertising dollars. So like earlier, talked about sort of the shadow sentence, news scroller structure of news that we get today. You know, it's a sort of, you know, opinion-dominated, dramatic, performative, argumentative news, clickbaity, listicle-dominated accounts of events that are too complex to describe in one sentence. Yet that seems to be the genre of content that tends to attract more clicks in an attention economy. And that's the kind of economy that we live now. So it's not so much the sponsors or the large firms, but rather the kind of content that is created by funding model relies too much on advertising. So advertising for advertising and, of course, funding for journalists to work well, but also some reliance on the subscription model and also some thought to be given in news organizations running as nonprofit organizations, so following the model of nonprofit institutions.
Yeah, media outlets as not-for-profits, and we do see a few of those. I want to go back to the role of journalists for a second. And Mike Wagner, I'll ask you, in your role as a professor at UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, should journalists be worrying about the health of democracy when they're doing their jobs every day?
It's important for journalists to begin with the verifiable truth, and if the verifiable truth tells us that democracy in, say, this country is under threat as compared to most other times in our country's history, it's worth journalists telling us so. And we see some news organizations taking that seriously. We see the Washington Post, for example, hiring a set of journalists to cover democracy in the states. The former Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Patrick Marley is now at the Post covering Midwest issues related to, you know, the project of democracy. And so I think it's important for journalists to do that. And too often, the most elite mainstream sources will fall back on framing politics as a game and treating both sides equally. And if one side is doing more worse things than the other side, but the coverage treats them equally, it's very easy for members of the public, especially those who aren't living and dying with the news but paying occasional attention, to conclude, oh, well, a pox on both their houses. Everybody's equally bad, even if everybody isn't equally bad.
Well, Vicky emailed us ideas@WPR.org and said she's concerned about how the media is able to set the narrative. For example, Vicky says because the press constantly reports on higher inflation, it can cause some higher inflation. And if the press is telling us that prices are going up, well, then you expect them to continue. The same with recession. If you expect a recession, your behavior changes and it induces a recession. So how should the press balance this? And I don't know who's best to answer this. Eric, I'll turn to you.
Oh boy. This is a monster. I've heard that a lot with respect to inflation, namely that all the coverage inflation has given companies cover to gouge prices and to basically foist unnecessary price hikes on the public because the public is expecting it. You know, I don't think the media can, I'm sorry, but I think that we as journalists have to report what's happening. And, you know, the problem is that in this day and age, and I think Zizi may have referred to this, there is so much media out there. Mm-hmm. There's just so much information out there. There's so much social media. There's so much Facebook. There's so much Twitter. There's so much all these other alternative social media platforms that there is no way you're going to stop the overcoverage of everything. And I mean everything. So there's just that is not, and it's certainly not something that, say, I or one particular editor can ever address, because I only cover my own space, right? I'm responsible for what I do. And for the media writ large to address the issue of overcoverage would require almost an antitrust violation, because we'd have to get together and form some sort of council to deal with this problem. You know what I mean? And that would not be doable. And that would also leave us open to complaints and gripes that we are a cabal
colluding,
which is already an existing mm-hmm. conspiracy theory to begin with. So we don't want to confirm the conspiracy theory.
You don't want to. Yeah. That's Eric Wemple, media critic for The Washington Post. Also, Mike Wagner joining us, journalism and political science professor at UW-Madison. And Zizi Papakarisi, head of the communications department at the University of Illinois Chicago, taking your questions about trust in our media landscape at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Jimmy in Valley Junction now. Jimmy, you're on the air with our panel. Good morning.
Morning. Yeah, I have a subscription to the Washington Post that I utilize, and something that bothers me is the hyperbolic story sometimes that it's supposed to be a news story, but you can tell the bend that the journalist is looking at. I'll give you an example: mm-hmm. chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. Now, right there. You know, you get the idea that, well, this journalist thinks that this whole thing is a disaster. And if it's going to be in an editorial, then it should be identified as one. And then that's fine. But there's so many stories that you could just, you know, and I know it's to sell, you know, sell clicks and stuff. But that does bother me that you give, you know, my thing is you give me the facts and you let me decide, you know, what the story's about and where to go with it.
Jimmy, I appreciate it. Not the first time I've heard the withdrawal from Afghanistan cited as information along with some point of view. Eric, since Jimmy is a Washington Post subscriber, I'll turn to you. When you're trying to describe the scene as a journalist, sometimes folks could see that as perhaps setting the scene.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, perhaps a more clinical thing, a clinical way to have said that would be so, you know, so many casualties during the withdrawal from Afghanistan. I think that would be the more of like the just the facts, ma'am, sort of approach on that. But I do want to defend the use of adjectives. Like I think that even beat reporters covering, say, the withdrawal from Afghanistan can use adjectives and can add an analytical voice to the coverage. I'd have to look at the entire article that he mentioned, but I do think that looking back, saying that the withdrawal from Afghanistan, you know, which people were, running along cargo planes on the runway and, you know, grabbing onto the wing, I think calling that chaotic is not in any way sort of a violation of journalistic norms. I think that that's a fair headline for what happened. If we wanted to dig deeper, as you mentioned, there was a lot of criticism about how the media handled the entire issue, namely that there's some critique out there that since the media was so hard on Trump, that they overshot in criticizing the Biden administration's execution of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. That's a debatable point. But I do think that there, you know, that in this day and age, there has to be some analysis in news stories. And I will tell you, otherwise, people just don't read them. Hmm. Go ahead.
We've got to take a quick break here. But Eric Wemple, media critic for The Washington Post, also joining us, Mike Wagner from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Zizi Papakarisi, head of the communications department at the University of Illinois Chicago. We've assembled the panel to take a look at your trust in us, in the media. With the time we have left, how do you size it up? 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Our panel this hour has been taking a look at our trust in the news media and where it's gone and what can be done to restore it. And that is where we will land this morning with our panel of guests. And I want to thank them so much for their time and information, their perspective. It's invaluable. But what do we do next? How can we restore trust in the media landscape? And we'll go to our panel one by one here. And let's start with Mike Wagner, professor at the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. What needs to be done to restore trust in journalism, Mike?
Many, many things, right? So some of them are things journalists can do, right? So some work shows that when journalists are more transparent about why we wrote this story, why we contacted these sources and not those, like basically having something you can click on the side of a story to say, here's the background, here's who edited this story, here are all the different versions of it. So just like a little bit of transparency can go a long way toward building a little bit of media trust.
You make it sound like a Wikipedia page where you can go back and see all the edits and how it all came about.
Yeah, a little bit in that same kind of regard. And then it's also the case that who we talk to matters. People who talk to others who have a more balanced media diet tend to become more trusting in news sources overall and more willing to use more news sources overall. So part of it's who we choose to expose ourselves to when we're having conversations about politics. And, of course, you know, we tend to talk less and less with people who are strong disagreeers with our point of view, when, in fact, doing that kind of thing may actually have a long-term benefit.
Eric Wemple, media critic at The Washington Post, what do you see as the top priorities for restoring trust in journalism?
Well, I just think it's primarily reestablishing the link with local news. I think that local news has been something like 20 or 30,000 journalists, primarily on the local level, have lost their jobs. We've lost tens, if not hundreds, of titles on the local level. That's where people sort of start their relationship of trust with journalism, because the local newspaper writes something and then they walk out onto the street and they can see that it's true. Or they can see, you know, that it may not fully be true and get into a relationship with the organization and say this is wrong, and then there may be a correction, and that establishes trust. So unless we reestablish the relationship between citizen and news organization on the local level, I think it will all be kind of a futile effort.
Does that imply the need for a viable economic business model for local journalism?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That is the key. And that is something that we've been casting about for the past 20 years.
And let me get to with the time we have left, and I apologize. We could have done this all day. Zizi Papakarisi, what do you see as the top priorities for restoring trust in journalism today?
Now, both of you are right. Historically, we started seeing like a huge slump at the point local journalism newspaper were being absorbed by larger newspaper conglomerates. The trust issue is complex, but it's not a huge mystery. We need to look inward. We need to ask ourselves, how do we build trust in our relationships? Why should other people trust us? What acts, what actions, what words build trust in relationships? What we expect, what the public expects from politicians, and from journalists, of course, because we shouldn't blame journalism for everything. Part of this problem has to do with growing mistrust of government institutions in general, and not just U.S. but wide.
Zizi, I apologize, we are out of time, but I want to thank you all for your perspective this morning. Zizi Papakarisi is the head of the Communications Department at the University of Illinois Chicago. Eric Wemple is the media critic for the Washington Post, and Mike Wagner, journalism and political science professor at UW-Madison. Thank you all for joining us this morning. Now, Tim Michaels was not a candidate for office until about 3 years ago. Today, he can make a plausible case that by next year, he could be governor. It's hardly a given, however, but the millionaire construction executive has reshaped this race. As Sean Johnson reports, he's also left many questioning how he would govern.
Tim Michaels and his brothers own Michaels Corporation, a Brownsville company started by their father that Michaels says now employs more than 8,000 people. This business, and Michaels' experience running it, is the foundation of his campaign. At a speech in Eau Claire, he tells voters he's not running for office because he has to.
I am not looking for a political career. I'm 59 years old. I am doing this to serve. President Trump didn't have to run for president, but he wanted to drain the swamp. I don't have to run for governor, but I'm going to go turn Madison upside down.
Michaels does not earn his living in politics, but he's no political newcomer. He ran unsuccessfully for state Senate in 1998 and for U.S. Senate in 2004. In the years since, Michaels has remained a major GOP donor, giving to a long list of candidates that includes Rebecca Clayfish, now his top GOP rival. There's nothing novel about Michaels' political outsider approach, but there's a reason candidates make pitches like this. In the right election cycle, under the right circumstances, it can work. Michaels supporter Kim Schmidt of Mondovi, Wisconsin, is in the crowd at Michaels' speech. She says she likes him because he has business sense.
I'm tired of long-term politicians. I think everyone is. It's time for a change here.
To some voters, Michaels' limited record as a politician is an asset. And it's definitely a benefit politically, says University of Wisconsin lacrosse political scientist Anthony Chergosky.
Tim Michaels has the freedom in many ways to take whatever positions he wants because we don't have a lot of past knowledge, at least recently, of what it is that Tim Michaels stands for. You know, he's not tied down to a lot of positions.
But Michaels has a couple other things going for him this year that have given his campaign a jolt, starting with the coveted endorsement of former President Donald Trump. Chergosky notes that Michaels has also been able to use his considerable personal wealth to blanket the airwaves with ads. Through the end of last month, Michaels had funded this ad blitz nearly entirely himself. He gave his campaign nearly $8 million of his own money.
I'm not a politician. I'm a businessman who knows how to get things done. I'm a self-made businessman who doesn't give a rip about the special interests or their money.
There's a reason President Trump endorsed Tim Michaels for governor.
I'm not a politician. I'm a businessman.
Clayfish has responded by attacking Michaels with the help of former Governor Scott Walker, her old running mate and boss.
I'm not criticizing him. I'm just pointing out the facts about his business.
Michaels' business, Walker notes, was once part of a contractors group that fought Wisconsin's so-called right-to-work law, banning mandatory union dues at private businesses. Michaels has also been active in groups that called for raising the gas tax. In an interview with WPR, Walker also brought up Michaels' decision to put his kids through school on the East Coast while his family was living in Connecticut and New York.
Fair or not, Democrats, if Tim Michaels were the nominee, would go after him and question how he can make the points about education in Wisconsin when his kids didn't go to school.
Michael says he bought the homes while Michaels Corporation was working on a massive tunnel project in Manhattan. The family stayed there when his daughter was fighting a rare form of brain cancer. He also pushed back on Walker's other attacks. He says he supports right to work and opposes increasing the gas tax.
This is a political smear. This is political garbage done by desperate candidates, career politicians who are finding themselves behind.
But on some big issues, Michaels won't say where he stands. When asked, for example, whether he'd certify the results of the 2024 presidential election, Michaels dodges. He says he's a businessman, a know-it-when-he-sees-it kind of guy. He'll make the best decision when the time comes. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And WPR's series of candidate profiles ahead of Wisconsin's August 9th primary continues tomorrow. And you can read all of those profiles online anytime at your leisure at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.